is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva, bringing you a conversation on democracy and Judaism. We are recording this conversation on Election Day in the United States. What seems to be a historical election, even though we don't yet know the results, and we are 99 days away from Election Day here in Israel. So we are in election fever, and we hope this will be the first of a series of conversations with our faculty at Web Yeshiva. Today we are talking with Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi Chaim Bravender and Rabbi Yitzchak Blau, who are longtime discussants from their long association, both as faculty members of Yeshiva Temiftar, where Rabbi Bravender was the founding Rosh Yeshiva for many years. They are both now with us, of course, at Web Yeshiva, and we're talking about the question of democracy as a political situation, as a political solution from a Torah perspective. To what degree is it legitimate? To what degree is it desirable? To what degree is it the ideal, particularly in light of the fact that it seems apparent that the Torah seems to prefer kingship as the ideal political solution? We will start with Rabbi Yitzchak Blau.
It seems to me that there are two complications in trying to derive political answers in a straightforward way from our traditional sources. And the first complication is the fact that we've gone nearly 2,000 years without real Jewish sovereignty and autonomy and self-government. And this means that there's less rabbinic discussion about governmental issues during this time. And even the discussion that exists was often in the theoretical sphere. So to speak, it wasn't tried in the crucible of reality where new cases come up and new phenomena have to be addressed. And I think whenever we discuss halakhic or Jewish issues of government, this is a difficulty. There are many spheres where this is true. If one looks at issues of military ethics and the like, one often has a sense that we're lacking the body of rabbinic literature we need over the years to truly address the issues. So I think that's one complicating factor. The other complicating factor is, it may be that inherently our system has more flexibility in these issues than other things. In other words, when halacha wants to define what a lulav is, it can define it fairly rigidly, and that definition can work for eternity. Right, there's a sense that that's something that there could be a more clear-cut answer to. And perhaps when it comes to national, economic, and political questions, there's a sense that clearly defined ritual answers are not that easy to come by. And it may be that the halakhic system, that Torah itself builds in a certain flexibility with regard to these issues. So these, I think, are two things to keep in mind when we're discussing, when we're looking at traditional sources about Torah and democracy. I just want to outline a few of the issues, a few different directions I think this conversation could go. One, as mentioned by Rabbi Sachs, one simple question is the form of government, right? The one possibility is to have a monarchy where the monarch is picked by the prophet coming from the word of God, where there's a hereditary inheritance of the kingship in a certain family line. And that is obviously quite different than a democracy where people are elected by popular will and they're changed every some odd years. There's no sense of hereditary transfer of power. Right? That's certainly one conflict we could talk about. Another conflict would have to do with certain cluster of ideas that we today associate with democracy. One issue might be the coercive power of the state. Right? Does the state coerce certain religious values, certain religious practices? Right? We'd associate democracy today with a certain freedom of religion. Perhaps halakha would have a more coercive element. That would be another conflict that one could talk about. One could talk about a conflict regarding where the source of legislation is. Is legislation ultimately the word of God, or is legislation coming from popular will? I think there's a series of potential conflicts we could talk about, and perhaps we'll get to them all here. I'd like to start with a few words about the first conflict, about the conflict of the monarchy. And obviously, if halakha demands a monarchy, if this is a mitzvah, so my opening caveat about greater flexibility would seem to be not true. Maybe halakha demands a monarchy, and that's something we should be striving for, even if today we're not able practically to fulfill it. So just to very briefly review some of the ideas, right, there is a passage in Dvarim, in Parsha Shoftim, where it says, Sohm tasim alechem. Arguably, this would seem to be a command to create a monarchy. Two factors right away perhaps call this into question. One is that the Pasuk introduces it in a very interesting way. It says, Va'amarta, the people will say, Sohm tasim alechem. And a question is raised, why the Pasuk needs to address it that way? Why is it dependent on the people's request? If it's a command, it's simply a command, right? So there are ways one could say it's a command and still deal with this problem of Amarta. Maybe the people are commanded to request it. At the same time, it calls the absolute command into question. Secondly, of course, is the reaction of Shmuel Hanavi when the people actually demand the Melech at the time of Shaul. Right? Shmuel is quite negative. And he also outlines the various possible, perhaps, abuses of power that are inherent in the system of monarchy. And if it's a mitzvah, well, it's hard to imagine that Shmuel would be so negative. Now again, as mentioned, those who think it's a mitzvah can deal with that. Perhaps Shmuel objected to the nature of the request, or the form the request took, rather than the basic request. But it does call the mitzvah into question. I'm not going to give a long share on this, I'll just mention this is really a debate throughout Jewish history. Already in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kafam Ibed, there's a machloket tanaim, a Tanitic debate, about whether the kingship is a mitzvah or not. If one goes to the Mefarshim on Chumash, one sees the same split. Right, with the Ibn Ezra on Sohm Tasim, says one word, Rishut. This is a voluntary practice. The Rambam famously says it's a mitzvah. And many Rishonim line up on different sides of this question. So already we see a certain debate about this. I'd like to focus on two particular sources, which I think will speak to us. One from the Middle Ages and one from modernity. And that is the ideas of the Abarbanel and the Nitziv. The Abarbanel, it's fairly famous, was not a fan of the monarchy. And one might argue that he personally experienced some of the possible abuses in the system of monarchy. And he suggests a system which really is quite similar to modern democracy. He says there's no reason why consensus cannot be formed from multiple voices. He's kind of responding to arguments for the kingship. Right, someone might say it's more practical. You have one voice, you don't have to deal with debate, it's easier to make quick decisions. So now there can be a system where you have majority vote among you could form a consensus. And he also says it's valuable to have a system where, right, he says, Lama lo tiena hanagot mishana l'shana l'gimol shane. Let it be for a certain period of time, and then other people will come in. And why is that good? So he mentions a number of factors. When new rulers come into power, they'll replace their predecessors, and they'll investigate the faults or even the sins of the earlier ones. I mean, you have a built-in system for correcting abuse. Right? In the system of monarchy, the king is just immersed in power. It's not clear how one confronts the abuse of power. Where in the more democratic system, so you vote them out of power, right? There is a built-in system of correcting abuse. Not only that, he mentions another factor later on. He says, actually I should really mention three factors. He says that since they're in power for a temporary period, and they know, right, so to speak, their quality of their rule is subject to review in the next election, the fear of humanity will be upon them. Meaning they have a sense that they're beholden to the people. That's another factor. I should throw in a third factor. He also says that there's more likely to be an abuse of power in one person. Right? There's no checks and balances. So the Barbanelli has mentioned a number of factors. The fact, the ability to throw the monarch out of, the government out of power. That fear that creates, to kind of serve as a check on how the government functions. And thirdly, the factor that one person is more likely to abuse the power. And even refers to, again, I'm not an expert on medieval government, but he refers to the governmental structure in Venice and Florence, where he points to a more democratic system, which he holds up as an ideal to show that it works pragmatically. And I think many of us, growing up in modernity, would relate and identify with much of what the Abarbanel says. That's one source I want to mention. The other source I want to mention, and I'll bring my opening remarks to a close here, is something that Nitziv says. The Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin is here working, he's the Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin in the mid-1800s. obviously coming from a very different culture than the Abarbanel. And he has an interesting reading of the word Va'amarta. Right? Going back to our opening question, I basically said either it's a mitzvah or it's not. Or perhaps to rephrase that, either it's an obligation or it's not an obligation. But if you're going to do it, the Torah tells you how to do it. There, of course, might be a third possibility, that it's an obligation given certain factors. So the Netziv says something fascinating that I think relates to my opening remarks. The Netziv assumes that there is no one ideal government. There's not even one ideal Jewish government. Halakha cannot say exactly how a government is supposed to behave, or how it's supposed to be structured, because it depends a great deal on factors of time and place. There could not be, again, a concrete, rigidly defined ideal government in the way that you could talk about the ideal etzrok, as it were. Right, so the Netziv says, how do we define it? The will of the people is a barometer of what the correct government of the time should be. Let's go back to the Pasuk. We noticed an oddity of the Pasuk. The Pasuk says, Va'amarta, the people have to request the king. Says the Netziv, if the people request the king, that's an indicator that at this time and place, a king would be the right thing. Right, again, if the Netziv gives a certain credence or a certain belief in the will of the judgment of the people, which I admit one could quibble with, one could say the people are getting it wrong all the time. But the Netziv gives a certain credence in the will of the people. If the people want the king, that's an indicator that perhaps the current structure really requires a monarchy. And then it becomes an obligation to install the monarchy. Whereas if the people don't make that request, then this is really not an obligation. And I think Netziv speaks very much to the issue at hand. So just to sum up what we've said, I realize I have not addressed some of the other issues of where legislation comes from, or the coercive nature of the state regarding religious matters. But I think regarding the monarchy, where I think many of us would really identify with things the Abarbanel says, one last line of the Abarbanel I'd like to quote. The Abarbanel says, he talks about Hanisayon Gover al Hakesh. What is Hanisayon Gover al Hakesh? Experience is more important than logic. I.e., he looks around and he says, we see that the monarchy leads to certain abuses, and in his time he thought the democratic institutions of Florence and Venice are a better model. I think certainly someone who's experienced the last 100 years of human history would very much identify with this. It's certainly not that democracy is a flawless system. It's certainly not that democracy, nothing immoral or problematic religiously could happen. It certainly can. But we look around the last 100 years of history and we compare democratic governments with totalitarian and fascist and communist governments, and even governments of the monarchy, and I think the competition is not even close. Right? The abuses of power and the mistreatment of people that's happened in a system of one leader of a fascist dictator and those types of government, I think they're far worse than anything that's happened under democratic governments. And in that sense, I think we agree with Abarbanel, Hanisiyon Gover al Hakesh, right? Experience in this issue should be more powerful for us than logic. Again, that does not mean there aren't a host of religious conflicts we have to address. We have to address, will the state coerce religion, where legislation comes from. I fully admit that. But I think at some ultimate level, our sympathies here are with the Abarbanel and the Netziv, that the Torah does not ultimately address or demand monarchy in every political situation, and that we very much identify with the advantages that democracy has bestowed upon peoples.
I think it was Churchill who said that democracy was the worst system of governance except all the other systems which have already been tried. Rabbi Brabender.
He was good with the phrase. I'd like to continue the thoughts that Rabbi Blau raised and maybe look at the whole problem from a different point of view. If we had the opportunity here in Eretz Yisrael to determine the kind of government that we thought was best, so we could look at it as he did, I think, in a kind of theoretical way. What's the theoretical demand of the Torah? Certainly there are opinions that the theoretical demand of the Torah is Malchut. There is such an opinion. And since we're used to the notion of being Machmir, right, in order to kind of satisfy all of the opinions that we can satisfy at once, we should go into this and try Malchut. I mean, how we would find the king and Beit David. Today we have different kinds of genetic testing for Kohanim, maybe somebody would invent genetic testing for the House of David as well somehow. There are, after all, famous Jews who claimed that they were descendants of David HaMelech. But there's another way to look at it, I think. And that is also something that Rabbi Blau mentioned, and that is, at the end, he discussed the Netziv's inclination to say that it depends. That Malchus is a tremendous obligation on both sides. The obligation of the people to accept the authority and the obligation of the king to be able to use his authority wisely. And that's a difficult thing. Certainly the idea expressed in the Tosefta and Sota that the king had to walk around with the Sefer Torah strapped to his arm in order to indicate to himself that he's obligated by the Torah. B'malochem yimlochu, that the pasuk in Mishlei. That itself indicates, I think, the difficulty of the undertaking. And even if you don't sympathize with this notion of the difficulty of the undertaking, you have to admit that a cursory reading of Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, Melachem Aleph, Melachem Bet, at Divrei HaYamim Aleph and Bet, and maybe even a less cursory reading would also be good, seem to indicate that not everybody, in fact most of the people who were called kings, just didn't do it very well. And the measure of their lack of success is hard to believe. I mean, it was almost true that they denied the very Torah itself. They reestablished idolatry where it didn't exist before. They acted in a despicable manner, to say the least. And even though from time to time there was a light, Yoshiyahu HaMelech or Chizkiyahu HaMelech, but overall Malchut passed down by the father to his biological progeny didn't seem to actually work. You know that the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuva, when he discusses free will, he says you could be a wonderful person, a righteous person, even a person like Moshe Rabbeinu, but when he looks for the evil person, he says you could be as evil as Yerovam ben Nevat. Now you know Yerovam ben Nevat was appointed by a prophet to be the king of Israel as a punishment, I guess, to the attitude of Shlomo HaMelech and his son Rechavam, who were Shlomo HaMelech, of course, had tremendous redeeming features, but Rechavam only inherited the negative and the oppression that he planned against the Nei Israel. And he, Rabban ben Nevat, was appointed by the Navi to be a balm or a salve to the terrible situation that was being created, and here he turns out to be the worst of people. Of course, it's discussed in the Gemara at the end of Sanhedrin, but that's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is that Malchus, even when the Melech is appointed by the king, is no guarantee by the prophet. I mean, is no guarantee that he will be able to match up to the hopes that people had when he was first appointed. The second experience that we had with Malchus in Eretz Yisrael was, of course, the time of the Hashmonaim. And there it's not clear they did the right thing or the wrong thing, whether they denied the mitzvah of the Torah since they were Kohanim. Okay, there's this kind of argument about the initial phase of Hashmonaic leadership, but there is no argument about the final phase of the Hashmonaic leadership, what it developed into, and actually in many ways produced the destruction of the temple. I mean, the situation in Eretz Yisrael on all levels was so difficult and so unbearable to heaven that the only possibility would be destruction. Now, we as Jews have had good experience with democracy since the French Revolution. It's true that democracy, of course, has its roots in Greek thinking and Greek organization, but if we take the period from the French Revolution, even though not a, if you compare the situation of Jews who lived in kingdoms and the Jews who lived in democracies, I think there's very little doubt that democracy has provided the Jews with a good way of dealing with disparate needs of the larger community and of their own community. And it was that ability that the founding fathers, if I call them that, of the state of Israel, thought to bring into Eretz Israel. And since today we know that Eretz Israel is a country in which 80% of the people are not Orthodox, maybe more. I mean, it's hard for me to define exactly what Mesorati means, but they're not Orthodox. I mean, they don't, 80% of the people are not Orthodox. And yet, in an amazing manner, democracy has provided Orthodoxy against the will of many of the leaders of the old-time or primary Zionists who would have liked very much, who came from a world in which religion was deemed to be unnecessary and divisive at best and mentally retarded at worst. They would have liked to do away with it for the good of the people. I mean, they didn't cut the payers off of the Yemenite children because they wanted hair to make shaitels. They cut the payers off the Yemenite children because they thought they were doing them a favor. I mean, it could be that there was achzariyut, you know, there was a wickedness also in there someplace. But you imagine, you go to, it's like the English, you go to India and they say, we're going to bring you the real world. I mean, we're going to bring you what we have. You have gold and silver, and we have modernity and progress and literature. And I think that that's what happened also in Eretz Israel. And nevertheless, in spite of all that, the Jews, because of the democracy that exists, and because of the crazy system that we have here, crazy, I mean, using my background as an American as a basis, we have this crazy system that a party that has 10 votes or 10 or 12 seats out of 120 can create the government, so to speak. So this crazy system, which, you know, I'm not sure why this system was chosen over the American presidential system, this crazy system,
which also has its craziness.
Okay, it might mean like in the States vote, and what do you mean?
Every system has its own...
No, but once you elect a president, he's the president. I mean, here, when you elect
him... Even if he got fewer votes than the other guy.
Okay, that's true. But once he
every system,
his job...
Every system will occasionally hiccup.
But this system, the system in Eretz Israel, allows a small group of people numerically to have a tremendous effect on the system at large. And who knows what a melech would do? I mean, objectively speaking, I mean, if you put it into the context of the Netziv or the Abarbanel, if that's what you are inclined to do, and say it's not so much an argument with Malchus because Malchus is really impossible, and you put it into the context of the Abarbanel and the Netziv, it turns out that not only is democracy possible, not only is democracy a reasonable kind of choice, but democracy turns out to be a great choice. It's the only choice, and it's a great choice, because the results in the state of Israel indicate that democracy allows people to have influence, even if they are not the ruling party. It's true that sometimes they get upset about not having as much influence as they would like, but you see clearly by just testing the number of people who are learning Torah, the number of advantages that, not advantages, but the number of leniencies sometimes that religious soldiers have because of their needs as religious people, you see that democracy has allowed all of this to happen, whereas it's not certain that a monarchy would be able to do it. And it's interesting, you know, they always say Rav Moshe called America a Malchus Shel Chesed. Malchus Shel Chesed, he could have said Demokratia Shel Chesed. But he said Malchus Shel Chesed because Malchus means that there's somebody in charge. Maybe that's the pshat, that you can choose a melech, but you have to have somebody in charge. And so when Bnei Yisrael came to Shmuel and Levi, they said two things. One thing they said was, we want a king. And the second thing they said, we want somebody in charge. Shmuel and Levi said, but I'm in charge. They said, no, you're an intellectual, you're a thinker, you believe that good and bad works itself out somehow. We want somebody in charge. So the model that they had at that time, of course, was a king. So they said a king. But today, Rav Moshe says, America's Malchus Shel Chesed, even though every 4 years there's a new melech. So maybe that's what he meant. That also covers the notion of Malchus if you interpret it in a certain way. And even though, okay, it's true that we like to go the Chumrah, like, and take care of all the Shittot, but here no one's asking us in America how the system of government should work. And to call it Malchus, I think, is a great compliment to the American system and what it has enabled the Jewish people to do. So I think here in Israel, in Eretz Israel, even though there are some children running around in the West Bank who somehow learned about Melech, they learned that passion when they went to shul last or something, and they say, it's how real Jews, you know, would have a kingship. I mean, to me, it's inconceivable at the amount of lack of thought that goes into that position, and that it's quite obvious that Eretz Israel is doing a wonderful job, really, in spite of its problems. We know that there are problems at integrating large communities that are disparate from each other, have different needs and different desires, and yet somehow feel that they're all included in the system, even though there are gripes, of course. There are people who feel that they haven't gotten enough and they haven't got ahead enough and they aren't able to do what they want to every time. But in general, everybody has. One last point, and we talk about the religious people. You know, Rav Kook was the one who didn't want women to vote and who was very skeptical about joining hands with the, even though Avas Yisrael, of course, said you work, you know, everybody is in the deal. But working together, he was a little skeptical about. And so also Agudat Yisrael and the various offshoots. But today, everybody's in. I mean, the only people who are not in are the, what they call the Torah Karta, which, of course, they're not in because people talk about them. If they were in, people stop talking about them and realize that they don't really exist. The head of Hatzolah, who was an ex-Deturk Karta person, once said, was interviewed, I heard him interviewed on the radio, and that he was given the honor of lighting one of the torches on Yom HaTzmaut, and he took the honor. So they interviewed him on the radio, and they said, what happened to you, Meshi Zahab? You're the Deturk Karta. He says, I changed my mind. They said, well, how do you change your mind? He says, well, first I thought that 5 million people were wrong and 500 people were right. And then I realized that 5 million people were probably right and that the 500 people were wrong. So it seems to me that that's what democracy has produced. Everybody is in, not 100%. And not everybody, just like not everybody in Knesset comes to daven mincha. Not everybody who davens mincha goes to every function that might be organized by the Knesset, but everybody's in. Everybody is part of the system, and for this we have to thank democracy.
Our eschatological hopes that Yemos HaMashiach will somehow look like the way things were in the days of a melech proper.
Yeah.
Are you prepared to say that that might that might not be the case?
Look, I think I have a different take on eschatological hopes. I don't think eschatological hopes relate to the future and they relate to the present. When Rav Nachman of Bratislava says that Asuli Yaesh, you can't be depressed, what he means is that you can't think that the situation that you're in, it's forbidden to think that the situation that you're in cannot be adjusted by heaven. And that's what faith in the end of days gives us. I don't have to know exactly what the end of days are about. Pace, Rambam, Hilchot Melachim. I don't have to be able to define who the Mashiach is and how he will appear and what where he'll get his suit and you know, for his major appearance and whether it'll be on YouTube. But I don't have to know any of that. But I have to know that there's an end. And if there's an end, that means that it has an effect now. It's a now thing. And the now of it is that I'm optimistic, that I'm hopeful, that even I, in my miserable situation, am moving things in the right direction. So why should I be depressed? I'm not saying this is an easy thing or that, you know, it's a solution to mental or emotional issues, but it's a point of view. It's a point of view where you can de-emphasize this idea that we're going to win because the Mashiach is going to come, which may be true, but it's not so relevant to me. And instead, I replace that by the notion that if the Mashiach is going to come, so I'm winning now. I'm doing the right thing. I'm moving in the right direction. Whatever little movement I'm able to generate.
I'm not sure you answered the question. I think what you said is we don't know.
No, we don't know about the future, but since we know that that will be the future, then it has an effect on the present.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay, I would say it a little bit differently. Perhaps this is what Rabbi Romner is saying. It's like the gap between the Messianic era and our current situation means that we can't really read back from the political structure we envision in the Messianic era to now. I think it's true, even according to the Rambam, who has someone more of a naturalistic understanding what the Messianic era will be. Even if one reads his account of Hilchot Melachim, there's quite a gap between life as it exists, Yemot HaMashiach, and as it exists now. So I think we can go on positing that there will be some restoration of Malchut without that indicating that that's the ideal government in the here and now.
Or that, in other words, one can imagine a Malchut which still operates under some kind of democratic impulse.
You mean like England?
I wouldn't say exactly like England.
I'd like to pick up on two things that Rob just said, and I think we're not going to disagree at all here. He mentioned Rav Moshe's phrase of Malchut Shel Chesed. Perhaps it's a certain way of thinking of Malchut as actually opening the petach to democracy. And this is as follows. This is something actually I picked up by reading an article by Professor Blitzstein in a book called Tolerance, Dissent, and Democracy. And he quotes a phrase from Avraham Lichtenstein called the civil sovereign. And the point seems to be, arguably, a religious community would want religious leadership to make all the decisions, right? So who should be running Israel? So the rabbis, the Sanhedrin, the Navi, they should be making all these decisions. And it's quite fascinating that there's another institution called Malchut. Now, perhaps it's unfair to call Malchut secular, and certainly the Melech is supposed to represent religious vision. As Rabbi Bravner mentioned, he's supposed to always have a sacred Torah with him. So he does represent religious values, or at least ideally, he should represent religious values. At the same time, he is a separate body of leadership, distinct from the Sanhedrin and the Rabbanim and the Nevi'im. So perhaps, again, I'm not equating, of course, Malchut and democracy, but just that the very basic Torah system, even positing that Malchut would be an ideal, is also assuming that there's a civil sovereign who runs things, and it's not necessarily the rabbis who are making every civil, social, and political decision. That's one thing I want to point out. The other thing I want to point out, Rabbi Brown there mentioned, you could in theory say, we should be machmir here, right? And since some positions, the Rambam and others, think that kingship is a demand, is an obligation, we should be machmir and follow that position. Of course, as is often the case, you know, one of the things we evaluate when choosing to be machmir is what's the cost of being machmir. And if we really agree, which I think Rabbi Brown and I, and perhaps many listeners would agree, that given the current political reality, democracy is more efficient and serves the Jewish people in a much more effective way. So it would seemingly be a reasonable choice to not be machmir on this particular issue.
I think I agree with generally with what Rabbi Blau was saying. And I would just like to add, at the beginning he mentioned that religious people might be interested in a kind of governance by rabbis. But the rabbis, I mean, how would they govern? Smart rabbis, I guess that's what we're talking about. I mean, smart rabbis realize their lack of knowledge and experience in certain areas. And governance is not like telling somebody it'll all be alright if he drinks a bottle of water. It's a heavy kind of responsibility, and therefore, even though, I mean, it's kind of comical that even though in the religious parties all accept the some sort of determination by a rabbinic personality, but the rabbinic personality is totally dependent on the report of the Chavrei Knesset to tell him what is actually going on. I mean, he's not going to go to the Knesset and sit there instead of learning Torah. So that it's true, it's always good to have another clever person add his voice to the analysis, but the analysis often comes from outside of that religious personality. And it's good, it's a very good system. Certainly the religious personality who knows a lot of halakha, a lot of Torah, might be able to be sensitive to a problem that the Chavrei Knesset, because they spend all their time doing other things, would not be sensitive to. So I think symbiotically it turns out to be a good thing to have different kinds of advisors. And just like everybody would certainly go to an expert in military affairs, an expert on economic affairs, and even though you always say you have to make the decision yourself, I think that going to an expert on Judaism is not uncalled for in any of these any of these things. But we have to recognize the fact that the expert on Judaism is an expert on Judaism, and his ability to relate to the civil issues or to the governmental issues is totally dependent on what people tell him, and the people who tell him things get used to it. I mean, I'm not saying that they're bad people, but if they have issues, they probably learn how to present it so that their side of the issue sounds better. Again, I'm sure that the religious leadership are not a bunch of fools and are not easily duped, but I can see that this could become a kind of a sort of expertise that you develop. You know, a lot of the Chavrei Knesset, the religious parties, a Chavrei Knesset for a long, long time, and they learn how to make the presentation. The fact that now Kadima was not able to form a government because of Shas, I mean, I guess it'll take a long time to figure out who generated that situation and why it was impossible for Shas to join the government. Who knows whether it was from the Rabbanim down to the Chavrei Knesset, or from the Chavrei Knesset bounced up to the Rabbanim and coming down. I mean, it's a very hard thing to assess, but in general, I think it's a good thing for religious people to be able to seek advice and talk about their problems, I mean, their administrative, national problems with Rabbanim, Yidolei Torah. And I'm sure that they would have important things to say about those aspects. And it's not a denial in any way, I think, of democracy. You know what I mean? That's what people do. I mean, people talk to others who they feel are experts, and they try to listen carefully. gain like 50 years of expertise in a half hour conversation. That may be a problem in government today.
Well, that being said, America, of course, has written between the lines, the stripes of its flag, the notion of a separation of church and state, separation of religion and state. And there's a general notion that may seem paradoxical, but in fact, that separation is what's created America as probably the most, religious, certainly the most religious democracy. I'm leaving out certain fundamentalist, maybe some fundamentalist Islamic nations, the most religious democracy in the world. In other words, religion is just so deeply enrooted in the American civic culture in its own way. Here in Israel, of course, we don't have that separation of religion and state, and that leads to, stemming, of course, from from this apocryphal meeting between the Chazon Ish and Ben Gurion, the status quo in which halachic Judaism, sometimes halachic Judaism as interpreted in the hands of right-wing Haredim who are not even partners to the vision of a Zionist state, are in a position to enact what's interpreted by some as coercive legislation and to set a certain agenda. And, of course, there were people over the years, such as Rabbi Yehuda Amital, who argued that, a separation of religion and state in Israel will lead to more religion, although perhaps not as envisioned by those descendants of those ideological descendants of the Chazon Ish. What do we think about that? About the so-called status quo here in Israel?
I think I came from America where it was sort of, I was taught since I was a little kid that separation of church and state is a good thing. And so when I came to Israel, I found the fact that there were religious parties somewhat annoying. But today especially when some religious parties of the Mahdal ilk have kind of admitted that they have disappeared. So I see that that it was a temporary thing. I mean, it may be that at the beginning, in order to establish a reshet, a series of schools called Mamlachti Dati, you needed a religious presence in order to maintain them, in order to set up the yeshivotas there and make sure that they would be funded. I mean, it may be that the system, the people who came from other societies, Eastern European societies, where they may have thought in different ways about religion, maybe the only way to deal with that situation was a church and state integrated policy. But I see that just yesterday, that the Mafdal committed Harry Carey, which was not a result of the fact that they were...
They've explained to our listeners what you're referring to.
The Dati Lumi, the religious party, the famous...
The religious Zionists.
Religious Zionists. Made a coalition with other right-wing parties and are blasting that they are not any longer a strictly speaking religious kind of party, but they're looking for other people who have similar views to join with them. In other words, the fact that they were religious or had a religious orientation was simply no longer tenable. I mean, they thought people would vote for them. They certainly wouldn't have done this. But they don't think people will vote for them, even though there are more young people today in Yeshivot there, more young couples in Kollelim, more people who...
More Dati Lumi, more religious Zionists.
Religious Zionists who might vote for... But they see that what has been accomplished has been accomplished, and it doesn't seem that there's really any point to maintaining the framework. And so they're jettisoning it. And maybe that happened in America. You have to also be a more of an expert. America started out as a very religious society. It's very interesting that religion was not incorporated into the system of government. That deserves a discussion by people who are really experts in it. It's an interesting it's an interesting question. So I think that that's the way of the world. I mean, as long as the Haredim see themselves, so I have two things you have to say of the Haredim, right? One is that they're in. I mean, they're in the Knesset. I mean, they walk around, they talk, they walk, and they have this job and that job, and they're important, and they have to say things that are oriented to the Bidina. Like when Litzman was, Haver Knesset Litzman was head of the finance committee, he couldn't just say, I'm just here to get money for Haredim. He had to say that he's here to get money for everybody, whatever it is that he thought that had to be done. So they're in. So I imagine that something similar, that even though the control in the Haredi community is much stronger, but even in 1977, starting in 1977, there was bleeding in the direction of the Likud. So a lot of people who saw the Likud as an opportunity, and especially the Haredi guys who fly on planes and do business and are, you know, upwardly mobile, so to speak, they're not so locked into the traditional forms. And even though Rav Shach was a great leader and had a tremendous influence, for example, I think that ultimately what happened to the Mafdal is in some ways the Haredim are the Mafdal of now, because once the Mafdal was concerned about Shabbos, for example, in the Medina, how it would look. They had this idea that, okay, you have a challah Shabbos at home, but nationally you should be Shomer Shabbos. Now, no Dati Lumi person thinks that anymore. I mean, they're not going to make a party based on that. But the Haredim, they do think about that. They're sort of like moved into that niche. Right. And I assume that they'll keep moving. They'll be moving just as the Mafdal moves. So that, I think democracy implies a separation of church and state, because the idea that there's some other force that is going to make decisions is really unacceptable, I think. I mean, I can't explain that now. And therefore, and I think that the religious people understand that they can't be a part of a system which sometimes will knock them down as religious people, but if they were just an interest group, that would be fine. It would work out better. Because, you know, you win some, you lose some, right? But you don't have to sign the check. So I think that that the way, I don't know why in America that system was preferred, even though, you know, there are always rumblings about creationists and, all these kinds of things go on in America. But in Israel, I think that the movement will definitely be more open and accepting, and maybe they'll be Haredim in the Knesset, but they'll be part of some larger body that, because there's no point to it. There's no point to being a Haredi in the Knesset once you get the money.
Look at America. If your prediction is right that Israel's moving away from it, I wonder the degree to which America is moving towards it. In other words, not that there'll be a blurring of the iron wall between religion and state, but 25% of the United States are evangelical Christians, yeah, or born-again Christians. And okay. I mean, you see the degree to which even the selection of Palin as vice president to just pander to this group.
It's true, but my assumption is that the New Yorker will win. That someday they'll read the New Yorker.
We are all three of us avid readers of the New Yorker. On the shelf behind you, there's an interesting book which was written probably 15, 18, 20 years ago by the great analyzer of these set of ideas, Gary Wills, called Under God, about the role of religion in American society and American politics.
Even though my basic sympathies are against religious legislation, religious coercion, I think it's a mistake to posit democracy and religion as polar opposites, and that democracy is totally in favor of individual freedom, and religion has this coercive element. I mean, democracies have coercive elements as well. There are communal values that are realized in a coercive way. Governments collect taxes, and a certain amount of that tax money goes to museums, so that's a value judgment that this is something that should happen in society. One couldn't possibly run a government without making some value judgments, I guess, unless one takes the fully libertarian position, which seems to me not such a practical position. The argument that some liberal thinkers make that religious values have to be excluded from the public square because they're not shared by everyone in the constituency seems to me totally fallacious. But that's what a democracy is. People have different values and different ideals, and they're all brought to the table. And there's no reason why the religious judgment should be excluded from the public discourse. And from that perspective, if religious parties is the best way to ensure that those religious values are part of the public discourse, so then maybe religious parties are a good thing. I think that that's something to keep in mind. I think there's a whole movement now of what's called communitarianism, arguing against the more individualistic perspective of how man works. People like Charles Taylor and Michael Sandel have claimed that liberal writers often portray every individual as the atomic self. It's just that individual whose freedoms need protecting. They point out the individual identity himself is part of a group, doesn't come out of nowhere. Right? The individual identity is formed in a community. And certain communal values are part of that individual identity. Right? You can't just think of what the individual, every individual per se would need for protection. Right? These communal values should be part of the communal discourse. And again, perhaps religious parties is the way to advance those needs. Right? Arguably, religious parties in the government have been crucial for certain getting funding for certain religious projects. At the same time, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think we have a real sense that coercion is often problematic. Quite frankly, it's often counterproductive. We'd like to encourage the more secular part of the state of Israel to be interested in religion. And often their perspective of religion is the one that tells them what to do when they don't want to do it. Or, unfortunately, certain more extreme elements, both in the Haredi world and in the Dati Lumi world, have sometimes contributed to giving religion a bad name. And we need to think how to win one of them over, and I think often in a more educational manner. And this is something that one gets in many acronyms, in the sense that perhaps it's a good thing that we've lost the ability to coerce. Where Cook has a famous letter with freedom of opinion, where he views it as a sense of divine providence that we've lost the ability to coerce in these matters. A very, very different, important Rav, Rav Henkin, certainly did not agree with Rav Cook on a host of issues. Rav Henkin basically says the same thing. He also views as an act of divine providence that we've lost the ability to coerce. And I think this is something that maybe from even a religious values perspective, it would be a good thing to try to bring people to religion through education, through basic human decency in our encounters in the streets. I think that will be more effective in the long run than coercion and legislation.
But there's, in other words, in the distinction between the atomic self and the more communal notion, the problem with sectarian politics, whether it's religious sectarian or any other type of sectarian politics, and we have a lot of that here in Israel, of course. You have political parties on every, a number of years ago there was a party that ran for the Knesset called, I think it was called Al Hagalgal or something like that. It was a party of taxi cab drivers. And I was very surprised that they didn't win and form the government, because their platform was they were against traffic jams. And whether you're left, right, or center, whether you're secular or you're Haredi, nobody likes traffic jams, but they didn't pass the threshold and get in. But that just shows the ridiculousness of the whole thing. There's a party that runs every time for Knesset, the Green Leaf Party that wants to legal, on the one issue of legalizing marijuana. There was a party that got into the Knesset last time and was actually influential in helping form the government, the Gimlaim, the retirees, right, which is a very important sector, more important than those others that I mentioned, but brings a very narrow set of issues to the table. And in the distinction between the kind of a communal mindset where you try to look at what's best for our society, the coercion, or what's viewed as coercion, where one sector, a minority sector, is able to leverage, because of the uniqueness of our parliamentary system here in Israel, where one sector is able to leverage legislation and societal norms based upon what they think is best for the entire commune, even though the majority may disagree with them, is a different kind of thing. It's not what Rawls was thinking, when he talked about the veil of ignorance, that everyone would act out of the best interests of the society at large, out of some kind of ignorance, or you could suspend your knowledge of what's in your own personal best interests, and then that would create the great society. That's not the way things work. No one suspended their sense of their own personal interests, and no one operates under the Rawlsian veil of ignorance. I think we have to state that when we talk about building a society, particularly when like I said, every system has its hiccups, where you have this hiccup based upon this historical status quo, which tilts towards the freedom. And I'm in favor of religious legislation, but I understand why it's objectionable to so many. Maybe one last question. Rabbi Brahm.
I'd just like to make a comment and tell a short story. The comment is that a one way of looking at coalition is that I make a coalition with people who say and think things that I'm not really against. I don't stand for them. And so that every party in the history of, until recently, it's always said, this party I'm not going to ever be able to make a coalition with, right? My pa used to say, communists are out. Because the communists had beliefs that Mapai could not absorb even tangentially into their way of thinking about things. But non-religious people can accept the idea that religious kids should go to school, and that the schools should have bathrooms, and they should be able to get bus to those schools. I mean, they may not be their issue, but it's not an issue that they're against. And the same reason that, say, the winning party could make a coalition with the marijuana party for its seat, if it got a seat. Because they'll say, okay, listen, you know, it's not my issue, but it's not that we would be so opposed to allowing people to grow marijuana. So that's what a coalition is. It allows you to accept positions which are not offensive to you, but this. You're not going to push for them. It's like a good thing for you. You can be pure and stick to your guns, and you have somebody else who does the other thing.
In some ways, that's the strength of Shas. That Shas is, in some ways, the most open-minded party, because they can and they have been the perennial coalition partner, whether the right is in power or the left is in power.
They have no opinion about anything except their own issues, which is a great way to do it.
Right.
The story is that a Rosh Yeshiva, a well-known Rosh Yeshiva who subsequently was Mitzvah, and therefore you can't check on the story, told me to follow the story. He told me the advisor, and his father was elected to the city council in Bnei Brak. In those days, Bnei Brak included more territory, it had a lot of non-religious people in it, and and the head of the city council, the mayor, was a non-religious person. So he went to the Chazon Ish, and he said to him, can I be in the city council? He said, so what's the question? The question was that in order for him to get money to support the Beit Yaakov system in Bnei Brak, he would have to vote for giving money to HaShomer HaTzair, who are openly atheistic in their position. Chazon Ish apparently responded without hesitation, of course you can. The important thing is what you do for the people that you are there to serve. And you hope that the other people will somehow be able to come around to your way of thinking. You're not doing anybody any good but not getting the money for Beit Yaakov. So this was kind of an ultimate integrative position, like recognizing where the other people were, even though they were totally non-religious and openly non-religious, not like today where people, everybody says in Yirta Hashem, it's like they have little card, index cards of must say, and they say things like that. And even Peres says in Yirta Hashem now all the time. Mm-hmm. Even though, I mean, Peres is an example of a person who was religious and became absolutely non-religious. Not like Begin, who is a person who always maintained connections with the tradition and with religion in one way or the other. Peres was not like that, but he sees that if you want to be accepted by the broad range of people in Eretz Israel and do something that's not going to turn you away from the non-religious sector of Eretz Yisrael. So you say, Yitzhashem. So I guess that's a good thing. I mean, it's sort of like it's an opener. It makes it easier to approach with other things. So the Chazon Ish was the one who said that if the cost is being respectful of the other person, it's the same. Yeah, and you just have to work in your direction.
Closing thoughts. I thank our panelists, Rabbi Chaim Bravender and Rabbi Yitzchak Blau. I'm Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva. We hope that you will tune in again for future discussions on other matters of import, and that you'll visit us at webyeshiva.org and sign up for the array of online interactive live shiurim that we offer. And remember, as they used to say in Chicago, vote early and often.